Well, before we began our celebration of the incarnation of Christ, we were searching for meaning to life. Why are we here? What is the purpose for our existence? Solomon, the richest and wisest of all men in history, has been addressing that issue. And from strictly a secular perspective, life under the sun doesn't yield any meaningful answers. And so Solomon has almost seemed depressed, hasn't he? I mean, boy, these first five chapters have been difficult. In spite of all that he knows, all that he has, all that he has accomplished, from a secular perspective, there's just no purpose in any of it. Why? Because he knows that death awaits him. And at that point, what good is all of the stuff that he's accumulated? I mean, what is really the purpose for our brief little time here on earth that we call life? You probably saw in the news the volcanic eruption in Indonesia that led to the tsunamis that killed 430 people and injured thousands more. It just happened back in December. And when those kind of disasters occur, it usually raises questions like, you know, what is the purpose for volcanoes? And why is it that those who live in the shadow of those volcanoes, why do they not heed the warnings that precede the eruption for 6 and 7 and 8 months? And the answer to the question why volcanoes is relatively simple. I mean, the Lord created a system for sustaining life on earth. And volcanoes are a critical component of that cycle that warms and cools the earth. Volcanoes are a critical component to the balance between the CO2 and oxygen. And if you ever look at how the plate tectonics and the volcanic eruptions and then how rain and all of that works together, it's fascinating. It's fascinating to see how the volcanoes not only recycle critical nutrients into the soil, they not only provide minerals for plant life, but how through volcanoes these gases release heat from the interior of the earth, where the Lord created a molten core that generates the magnetic field that shields us from the solar winds. And while sulfur dioxide that is released into the atmosphere reflects part of the sun's rays back into space, which keeps the earth from overheating, that is certainly a critical component. But there are other valuable aspects to why we have volcanoes. I mean, these components all work together to regulate the earth's temperature. And they not only deposit minerals that are broken down by rain and then absorbed as nutrients back into the plant life that gives off the oxygen that we all need in order to live, but there's the geothermal energy that is provided. There is the raw materials of sulfur and copper and gold that is all produced by volcanic activity. So it's pretty easy to explain why we have volcanoes. The Lord uses 1,500 of them, not to mention the ones that are on the ocean floor. He works all of them together to sustain life on earth. And just like we need the sun for life, overexposure can be harmful. Just like we need water for life, the potential for drowning exists if wisdom is not exercised. So it is with volcanic activity. I mean, there's a clear purpose for volcanoes. Yet if you don't heed the warnings that precede the eruptions, then lives can be lost. And that is true in other aspects of life as well. You know, if you don't understand the purpose for why man is to work, how he is to manage his income, how he is to view his marriage, how he is to treat his spouse, how he is to raise his kids, how he is to serve the Lord, if man doesn't heed the warnings that come with all of these good things that the Lord gives to us, and these are things that he gives to us for good in this life, and yet if we don't heed the warnings as to how they are to function together in order to provide meaning for life, then we end up with a destructive tsunami that can destroy us. And that's what Solomon is discovering. He's already said to this point, to be wise is better than to be a fool. He says it's better to be rich than to be poor. And yet all the wisdom in the world can't give life meaning. And all the riches in the world can't give life meaning. He says it's better to work hard than it is to be lazy. But what good is hard work if everything that man accomplishes, if all of the efforts of his work are just to accumulate this stuff, then what good is it in life if he has to leave it behind at death? So how are we to view this life that we've been given on earth? What warning signs are before us that Solomon is kind of flashing for us here in this text? At the end of chapter 5, he reminds us that our days on earth are few, so don't waste them. You're here for a purpose. Are you fulfilling that purpose? So in beginning in chapter 6, this is about the 18th time that Solomon has said, life, money, and stuff are not synonyms. He says, everywhere I look. You got to remember, Israel in that day was prospering like at no other time. Oh my goodness, this was at the end of 40 years of David's reign, which was the pinnacle of Israel's history. Another 40 years of Solomon's reign. This is almost a full century of prosperity. This is why when they were building the temple, the people kept bringing gold and silver and precious. I mean, and Solomon had to say, stop, stop, and they could not give enough. Man, this was unprecedented times in history for Israel. And yet Solomon says, everywhere I look, I see evil under the sun. What evil? What are you talking about? He said, we have so much stuff. I mean, the Lord has greatly blessed us. He's given us certain things here on earth that are meant to be enjoyed. And yet by making the gifts the focus of our lives, we've become materialistic brats. Brats who miss the point of life. By embracing the gifts without acknowledging the gift giver, we fail to experience the joy the gifts were meant to bring. And so he says we end up with this shell of a life that lacks any meaningful core. We work to accumulate all of these things and then we die. And what happens? What happens when we die? Our children try to unload all of the stuff that we've accumulated in a garage sale. And what nobody else will be willing to pay for, they donate. And strangers end up enjoying what you work for. What's his point? He's simply saying, look, don't count on all the stuff that you accumulate today to provide meaning for your life tomorrow. Because death awaits you. So you better enjoy life now. I don't plan to enjoy my grandchildren one day. Once we've got everything in place and everything is functioning here as it ought, and I reach that magical age where I'm supposed to no longer work, now I can go and enjoy. My grandchildren will be young adults and have no interest in grandpa at that point if I wait till then. I'm going to enjoy life today. I love the work that he has given me to do. I love the friends that he has surrounded me with. I love the family that he has given me. And that's what he says in verse 3 here. Children are a blessing from the Lord. So even if you've got 100 kids and you live 120 years, if you don't know how to appreciate the life that you've been given, if you don't know how to enjoy a good cup of coffee, if you don't know how to lay in bed at night and enjoy a good book, if you don't know how to go to a T-ball game and enjoy it without yelling at the umpires, or without yelling or scolding your son because he's so much like you, he made an error just like you, or failed to get a hit just like you. I mean, if you don't know how to enjoy these fleeting moments with those children, you're going to miss out on one of the primary blessings of life. Because you know what? In the years to come, who won, who lost, who scored, who didn't, it's not going to matter. Who cares? You know, all those plastic trophies that decorate your child's bedroom today will eventually end up in a garage or a basement or the garbage can. Back in the 90s, I was... enjoying the coaching my youngest daughter's AAU basketball team. And we went to 5 state tournaments, and we won 3 of them and came in second twice. I was one of the great coaches of history. John Wooden, you know, Gino of Connecticut, and me. And we qualified for 5 national tournaments. I've got trophies at home that are almost as tall as I am. You know where they are? The basement. They're faded. Some of the screws have come loose. Some of the things on the trophy are starting to fall off. The hardware is pretty much useless. But I wouldn't take anything for the memories. Man, what an enjoyable time of life that was. It was brief. It's a time in life which I will never be able to get back. But man, did I enjoy it while it lasted. Solomon says, look, don't spend so much time planning to live tomorrow that you forget to live today. A miscarriage who doesn't have a burial, who comes forth too early, is better off than the guy who has these wonderful opportunities in life and he misses them. That's his point. It doesn't matter how many blessings you receive. You could have 100 kids and live to be 120 years old. And if you don't know how to enjoy life, a miscarriage who escapes all of the pain that goes with living in a fallen world is actually better off than you. It's kind of as Ebenezer Scrooge said, it's better to never have been born than to get to the end of a life and realize that you've played the fool. Remember a guy named Jehoiakim? Jehoiakim was the last king of Judah before the Babylonian captivity. He had been a very blessed young man. He'd been born to a guy named Josiah. Josiah was a wonderful king. He abolished all of the idol worship throughout Judah, and the Lord was pleased with that. But his son was a fool. His son did not follow in his father's footsteps. He doesn't know how to appreciate the blessings of having a good father. He doesn't know how to appreciate the life that the Lord has given him. He gets so wrapped up in who he is as king and what he has and thinking himself to be the one that is in charge. He brings paganism back into Judah. And as a result, the Lord chastens them at the hands of the Babylonians. And King Nebuchadnezzar takes Jehoiakim and puts him in chains. You didn't enjoy or appreciate the good life the Lord has provided you, then it's going to be taken from you. And Nebuchadnezzar sees value, though, in propping Jehoiakim back up in Judah as kind of a puppet king that's now going to have to pay tribute now to this pagan authority. And during this time, as Jehoiakim is the puppet of Nebuchadnezzar, and as idolatry continues to flourish throughout Judah, there is a prophet named Jeremiah who calls Judah to repent of their idol worship. You know what Jehoiakim does? He goes out and he confronts Jeremiah, and he takes the scrolls from which Jeremiah is reading, and he cuts them into pieces and throws them into a fire. And as a result, the Lord says through Jeremiah that Jehoiakim will be treated like a donkey, that his body will be thrown over the city wall. In other words, he will have no burial, which is an indication of a disregard for life. And the wheels of God's justice grind slowly, but they grind exceedingly fine. And so year after year after year after year after year goes by, and Jehoiakim seems to think he's getting away with it, but he's not. 11 years in, he finally is so full of himself once again, he stops paying tribute to King Nebuchadnezzar. And when that happens, Josephus says the Babylonian king kills him and throws his body over the city wall, just as the Lord had said through Jeremiah. He had no burial, which symbolized his complete disregard for life. Jehoiakim, you had this wonderful opportunity to make your life count for something that would extend into eternity. I gave you a good father. I gave you the opportunity to make a positive difference in the lives of others. I gave you the opportunity to lead. You threw it away. You got so caught up in being king. You got so focused on the authority that you were given that you failed to fulfill the purpose for your life. A stillborn child is better off than you, Jehoiakim. Because you failed to enjoy the gifts that I gave you. You had the opportunity to make a difference in the lives of others, and you blew it. To do that is worse than being born dead. And to make his point, he uses a little hyperbole here. It doesn't matter if you live 2,000 years. If you don't get the point of life, what does it matter? Both the miscarriage and those who live longer than Methuselah all end up in the same place, don't they? They all end up in the grave. So make your dash count. You know, the dash that's on your tombstone that's between the date that you entered this world and the date that you left it. Make sure that you make that dash count for something significant. Just as some would ask, well, why would the Lord allow this child to be conceived if he was not going to be allowed to live? Those same people might also ask, why would the Lord allow man to have all these blessings knowing that he will not embrace them or use them or enjoy them as the Lord meant for him to do? Why? Why? Why is man even allowed to exist? So the question is existence without meaning any better than non-existence? That's the lingering question of verses 4, 5, and 6. And so Solomon gives us insight to the answer in verses 7, 8, and 9. Like one's hunger for food keeps returning even after he eats meal after meal after meal, so is one's appetite for wealth. You know, we usually think that it's the wise man who knows how to make money. But if wealth doesn't satisfy the purpose for man's existence, if accumulation of stuff cannot provide eternal sin, then does the wise man who knows how to make money, does he have any advantage over the poor man? Does he? He concludes in verse 9, you're better off to live with purpose than to feed a wandering appetite for more and more and more stuff. You ever seen the movie The Family Man? It's a movie that came out a few years ago. Nicolas Cage is playing a guy named Jack Campbell. He's a Wall Street executive in New York City who puts together multi-billion dollar mergers. And it's Christmas Eve. That's, I think, why they were showing it again last month. And he's called for an emergency meeting on Christmas Day. Yes, that's a holiday. Yes, that's a day when you're supposed to be home celebrating with your family. But you got to understand, this is the deal of a lifetime. And so he's going to call a meeting together of all of the guys that work for him to put together this merger. And they come in and they give him a message on Christmas Eve that a friend from his past has left a message to call her. It's his former sweetheart. And he's thinking, I got no time to call her. Not interested in her. I'm putting together the deal of a lifetime. I've got no time to make such a call. And so on his way home that night, he stops into a 7-Eleven to get something to drink, and he sees a guy trying to cash a lottery ticket, and the clerk won't cash it for him. He says it's forged. And so Jack goes over to offer to help this guy. He's going to buy the lottery ticket from him and then cash it for him and give him the money. It's $200. What he doesn't realize is this guy's not a normal guy. This guy is Jack's guardian angel. And so he offers to help this guy, and the guy says, well, thanks, Jack, for helping. Can I do anything for you? And Jack kind of laughs. Say, do anything for me? Are you kidding me? Do you know how much money I have? Do you know who I am? Do you know how self-sufficient I am? How wealthy I am? How powerful I am? I've got everything that money can buy. I've got a plush apartment that overlooks New York City. I've got expensive clothes. I drive a Ferrari. I enjoy the finest of meals at the nicest of restaurants. I've got it all. And you want to help me? Does all that stuff make life worth living, Jack? He goes home and he goes to bed in his expensive apartment and he wakes up the next morning and he's in suburbia. Suburbia. This guardian angel has transferred him into an alternative life that Jack knows nothing about. He wakes up married to his sweetheart. He wakes up living in New Jersey, of all places. No offense to New Jersey. He's got two kids. He works for his father-in-law, selling tires. He's mortified. He gets in the family van and races back to his old apartment, and nobody knows him there. The guys that worked for him in the billion-dollar mergers, they all have his job. They have his salary. They're living his life. That which he once lived now belongs to them. He is stuck in an alternative life without all of the pleasures he once enjoyed. But after experiencing blessings that he didn't even know existed in life, the wife he never had, the children he never knew, the joys that can't be bought with money from billion-dollar mergers have given him a glimpse of what is more important in life than being a big shot on Wall Street. And you know what happens to Jack? Is he falls in love with this life. He now realizes the blessings that he had been missing. He now is embracing the life that he has. He's enjoying it. And now that he has learned the lesson that he was meant to learn, it's time to go back. And he doesn't want to go back. He doesn't want to go to sleep because he's afraid that he will wake up in his fancy apartment. And so he does everything that he can to stay awake so that he won't lose the wife, the children, the house, the suburban life. He don't want to lose it. He doesn't want to go back to his apartment with his expensive Ferrari, back to his billion-dollar deals. But he has to, because that's real life for him. That's the life that he chose. And so he goes back at a really big price tag. He's got to give up the wife. He's got to give up the kids. He's got to give up all these wonderful blessings that he had never experienced until the guardian angel provided him with this glimpse of what life was supposed to be about. Outside a materialistic world that consists of stuff that cannot love him. And he no longer wants it, but he has no choice. The glimpse was not reality. It was only a glance at what could have been had he not made the choices that he made to pass on it. And so he goes back, but he's a different man with a different perspective on life. And he calls his sweetheart to ask what it is that she wanted. He now sees value in contacting her. And all that she wanted was to give him back some stuff that he had left with her from years ago. She's on her ways overseas to her big job. And he doesn't want this stuff. He wants her. He wants the kids. He wants a life worth living. He wants to be with people who love him. You know, the family man could have been written by Solomon. That's what he is saying. He's saying the same thing. Stuff can't guarantee satisfaction with life. Havel, Havel, it's all Havel. It's vanity. Missing the point of life is like striving after wind. I mean, if all you do is live to feed a materialistic appetite, then does a wise man have any advantage over the fool? Does the rich man have any advantage over the poor man in eternity? Not really. Not at all. I mean, his point is, it is better to accept what the Lord grants in this life, to enjoy it, to use it to his glory, than it is to always be dreaming and working and striving after stuff that simply leaves you empty at the end. So whether you are rich or poor, if you don't know how to enjoy what the Lord has granted to you or to use it in ways that glorify him, he says you are simply striving after life, or striving after wind. You can try to make life about you. I mean, who you are and what you accomplish, what you accumulate, but it's not going to work, folks. Why? Well, he tells you. The Lord is the sovereign author of life. In the beginning, he created the heavens and the earth. And he said, let there be light, and there was light. He said, let there be darkness, there was darkness. Man cannot change that. He determined that man would be created from the dust of the earth, but he also determined that our significance over the rest of the animal kingdom would be seen in the fact that we were created in his image. And we can't change that. The Hebrew word for man, Adam, is associated with the Hebrew word for dust, Adama. But unlike other living creatures whom the Lord gives life, man has been given an eternal soul. We have a moral compass. And yes, we do, by searing our conscience, we do distort that compass at times and make it unreliable. But you know what? We cannot change the fact that our soul is immortal. The Lord has determined this is what man is, and man cannot change that. He has determined that the earth is going to be located in this part of the solar system. And the solar system will be located within this part of the galaxy. And this galaxy will be located within this part of the universe. And man cannot change any of that. This is the universe I created. This is the solar system I created. This is the sun that I will use to sustain life on your little blue planet. This is the earth that I will tilt at 23.5 degrees to provide seasons and to prevent temperature extremes. I did that. You can't change that. I am the one who created the earth's molten iron core to provide a magnetic field that will protect you from the solar winds. I am the one who established the earth's atmosphere with a blanket of gases that not only provides oxygen for you to breathe, but protects you from the radiation that can destroy you. I am the one who maintains your orbit around the sun and the moon's orbit around the earth. And I do so with such precision you can establish your calendars and your years and your months and your days and your hours with extreme accuracy. As a matter of fact, you can set your watch by the faithfulness of my sovereignty. I am the one who has determined that each animal will yield their own kind. And that's why you cannot find snails producing birds and fish producing rabbits. Open your eyes, Adam, and see that all that I have created is the way that it is, and you cannot change it. I have called it into existence. You cannot alter it. Do you see that? Well, who are you? I am Yahweh. I am who I am. I am a self-existing, self-sustaining creator who has no beginning, has no end, and has no equal. So, Adam, don't try to be your own God. You're not qualified. I created you for a purpose, that being holy, I might glorify myself through you. And beyond that, you have no purpose. You have no purpose for being here. I am the creator. You are the created. Well, I don't want you to be my God. I don't want to live to your glory. I don't want to submit to your word. I don't want to bow a knee to your authority. I've got my own opinions. I've got my own ideas about life. I've got my own views. And indeed you do. But no matter how much you speculate, no matter how much you pontificate about life, you cannot change eternal truths that I have established. And so let the fool say in his heart, there is no God. You know, the word for fool in that psalm is naval. It doesn't mean that man is not intelligent. It doesn't mean that men cannot earn educational degrees. It doesn't mean that man can't come up with great theories or speculate about origins of the universe. It doesn't mean any of that. It just means that man's denial of what is actually the truth is foolish. It's nonsense. It doesn't matter how many books that he writes or how many theories he puts forth. The beginning of wisdom is to intimately know the one who created him. And if you can't know that, then you have no purpose in life. You've probably heard this before, but I think it bears repeating. You remember the two lights at sea? You know, one says you need to change your course. And the other responds, no, I'm an admiral, you change your course. And the other one says, I'm a petty officer, third class, but you need to change your course. The response is, no, I'm an admiral. I'm aboard a naval destroyer. I said, change your course. I'm petty officer, third class, sir, but I'm a lighthouse. I said, change your course. It doesn't matter how many degrees you have or how big your ship is. There is a constant in this universe that does not change and cannot change. It's a lighthouse that is immutably holy, immutably omnipotent, immutably eternal. And he does not change to accommodate our opinions or our attitudes or our decisions. He is immutable. Therefore, man does not break his word. Man is broken upon his word. It's like the guy who says, I don't like gravity, so I'm going to deny it. It makes me too heavy. That's fine. Deny it all that you want to, but don't be walking off of tall buildings. Because you're going to find that what you demand and what you think and what you believe and what you deny isn't going to change the reality of God's law. And so Solomon's point is, don't waste your life arguing with the Lord about life. You better be grateful for the privilege you have to just be a part of what the Lord is doing here on earth during your life. And so do that which has significance that extends into eternity. I mean, we don't always understand why some things happen the way that they do, but we don't need answers to why. We need faith that is anchored in the reality of God's sovereignty. That's Solomon's point. Yeah, I know it looks really, really bad that you don't understand this, Joseph. You don't understand why your brother sold you into slavery. You don't understand why you're in another country. You don't understand why Potiphar's wife lied about you. You don't understand why the baker forgot about you. You don't understand any of that. You have no idea why I allowed that to happen, but you've got to trust me, Joseph. Trust me that my purpose for your life is always best. And though you don't understand with your limited abilities what your role is in this bigger scheme of things, I'm telling you, somewhere down the line, you're not going to see through a glass dimly. You're going to be able to see clearly how 430 years from your days on earth, I'm going to bring forth a new nation from your seed that will bear my word to a fallen world that paves the way for the incarnation of the one who will satisfy the just wrath your sin deserves. And that is the reason for why I allowed your brothers to sin against you. That is the reason why Potiphar's wife lied about you. That is why the baker forgot about you. Is my good, pleasing, and perfect will was for you to not leave Egypt. But I had a purpose for taking you there. Yeah, I know it looks terrible at times. The disciples didn't understand either. How can we know, Lord? How do we know where you're going? How can we know the way? It makes no sense to us that one who is without sin is being put to public shame and crucified as if he were the worst sinner in all of the world. And yet through his death, men from every tongue, tribe, and nation will be reconciled with me for eternity. Because I have a sovereign plan that is immutable. I have an eternal purpose that does not change, that cannot change, that must not change. Because my will is holy, it's just, it's right. And therefore, don't you, O man, made from the dust of the earth, waste your years on earth arguing and rejecting and thinking that somehow you know better. The more you pontificate about what you think and the more you come up with ideas about how you believe life ought to be, the more words you use to reject my word will lead to an emptier life for you to live. Now, I know that most of us either have given up on New Year's resolutions or we've already broken the ones that we made. But here are three from Solomon that are worth your time and effort to cling to throughout the year. And one is, life is very, very short. Enjoy it today. Today. Don't be always living about what's going to take place tomorrow. Enjoy it today. Secondly, remember that a meaningful life consists of more than just stuff. It has to do with making an eternal difference in the lives of people. That's what extends into eternity. The stuff I have in my home will eventually go up into flames. But my children and my grandchildren are the only things I've got on earth I can take with me to heaven. Thirdly, the Lord is sovereign over all of my life. We need to trust Him. Trust Him. If you have any questions about that, if you have any questions about what it means to be a Christian, if you have any questions about being a member of the church, saying, look, I want to get started right this year, if you have any questions about how to be a spiritual leader of your home, you have any questions about any of the things that were said through the sixth chapter of Ecclesiastes, you have any questions about anything, we invite you at this time to go to the Connect table and let those folks know what your questions are, what your needs are, and we will be glad to meet with you one-on-one and help you to be all that the Lord has called you to be. Stand with me as we pray together. Our Father, we are so very grateful to be alive, but to also have a life that has meaning and purpose. We're grateful, Lord, that we have something to live for here that will not be consumed by fire. That we have a purpose whereby we can hear at the end of our life, well done, my good and faithful servant. And Father, you've made it extremely clear in your word. We would ask this morning that indeed you have been glorified through your word, through your message to us, that our hearts and our minds and our souls have been open to your truth, that we as individuals will respond to your truth, and that we will stay focused this year on making sure that we are living a life that's worth living. A life with purpose, a life with direction, a life that has eternal significance. And Father, I pray for all of the men in this church to love their wives as Christ loves the church, sacrificially, genuinely. That the wives in our church would be trustworthy helpmates that will give wise wisdom to their husbands, enabling him to be what you've called him to be. That the parents in our church would bring their children up in a way that their lives can be purposeful, that they can live in such a way that they glorify you. And Father, I pray that you would also work through our leaders, that they would lead by example, an example that others can follow. And by so doing, that this would be a church that is truly, truly, truly pleasing to you. Father, I pray that you would glorify yourself through our lives. For it's in Christ's name we ask it. Amen.